This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, it's been 20 years since President Bill Clinton pushed through his NAFTA free trade treaty, quickening the deindustrialization of America. And when imperialists call themselves champions of human rights, then human rights needs to be redefined.
But first, People's lawyer Lynn Stewart brought in the new year as a semi-free woman at home with her family in New York after the Obama administration finally released her from prison on compassionate grounds. Stewart is suffering from stage 4 breast cancer. She served 4 years of a 10-year sentence for zealously defending her client. Some of Stewart's supporters assume she's now free to do as she likes, but she says that's not the case.
That is not true. I have a 5-year probationary period. The constraints are not awesome. In other words, I have no curfews. I don't have to be drug tested. You know, I can visit anywhere. And, you know, there are no real geographical constraints except for traveling, which we can work out probably. So, but, you know, but they can keep an eye. And one of the restraints is I cannot associate with any felons. Now, where in our movement is that going to take place? You know, we've all been arrested for one thing or another. So, you know, that's going to be difficult. But we're going to figure it out. We're going to work it out. You know, I'm not going to go around saying I have to do the DNA of everybody who comes to our rally. You know, it's going to be okay. But, no, they'll keep it tight and loose, you know. Did I say noose? I should have said I hope I'll be able to live with it. I just think it'll be good.
Well, one of the things that you brought home besides yourself is what you call a victory. And how's that feel?
Well, you know, we in the movement, we have really gone a long time without a true victory. And by a true victory, I mean something that didn't happen because times changed and it just happened. But this was one, you know, where they would not give an inch and we would not give an inch. And it worked out in the end that they blinked first. And I don't mean that in some kind of cowardly, negative way at all. I just mean, you know, the pressure, the power. I mean, yesterday I had a call from somebody who called himself Arch. And I come to find out that was short for Archbishop Tutu. You know, people who contributed to this, people and the little people, the people who wrote to me, the law students who said, I want to be a lawyer just like you. You know, this is the power of this victory, that it was accomplished by the people, what we would call certainly the 99%, probably the bottom half of the 99%, the people who, you know, were able to raise themselves up and do the necessary energetic work, who read something or got a note from me and then called everybody on their list to come along and do this too. It really is, when I say it's a victory of the people, because the people adopted me as their heroine, and here I am. I'm here. I'm not being held in jail until I have 1 foot and I'm ready to be pushed into the grave. I'm out here. I'm determined to fight the cancer. I'm determined to become an activist again on our own terms. And that is the great victory, that I am out here.
You've said that you're going to dedicate as much time as you can to the struggle for freedom for political prisoners and on behalf of women prisoners. But you've always done that. How has your own incarceration changed the way that you might approach those subjects?
Well, of course, as far as women prisoners are concerned, now I can speak from experience, which is probably not the best teacher, but at least you can say authoritatively how bad it really is and how heartbreaking, you know, to see the women in prison, to see what the laws have done to them, to break them, to their lives. Women who were abused at a young age, who come through and never really become assertive, and here they are serving horrendous sentences. So I always had certainly a strong inclination to stand up and fight, and more importantly, to teach women to be more assertive. You know, how many times did I hear of the woman who goes before the judge and she tells me, well, you know, my lawyer didn't do this. And so I said, but what did you do? You should have done something. And give them the idea that they have power, too. As far as political prisoners, yes, indeed, I always fought for them. But I just feel that the time is so much riper right now to do something and get them home. I mean, if those people, our media monsters, can make Nelson Mandela into a sainted, can change him from the warrior he truly was, then we ought to be able to change these warriors that are in jail and present them as defenders of our community, the people who were out on a limb in the 60s and who were fighting a righteous battle, just like Nelson was. I hope we can turn that around. We're not interested in truth and reconciliation when the people we're asked to be truthful and reconcile with are racist. That, I think, is a misconception. But I think that we have, I've always maintained, of course, that when you visit, when you become friends with, when you write to a political prisoner in this country, you are enriching your life. And I think we have got to change our approach and not make them into such, yes, victims, but they are their own men and women, and they stand up, and they stand up very well.
Eric Holder and his Justice Department are making noises as if they have had a change of heart on mass incarceration, although there's been little of substance to indicate that that's the case. Have you been following these so-called reforms on the part of the Justice Department?
Well, they are certainly a lot of form and no substance, because, you know, he made this speech out in San Francisco in August. And I, along with a lot of other people, I think, thought, okay, now there'll be change. So what was the change that he made in terms of compassionate release, which I was relying on? He now involves the U.S. attorney, and the U.S. attorney actually put some kind of a negative, not too long, but they took a long time to come to the position that they would make the motion for me. So I don't see, I fear he is just very much like his boss, who is a lot of form, no substance at all. I mean, we see the shameful lack of pardons, the shameful lack of commutations. And as I see it, you know, the jails are fuller and fuller and fuller of people doing horrendous sentences. And this, to me, is incarcerating a generation of people, mostly black, mostly Latino, and making sure that they're not out there doing the political thing, learn the political answers. Because, of course, we were fortunate enough in the 60s to be able to learn that the problems that we faced had political answers. These kids are in jail. They don't learn very much except with some on MTV.
How useful are lawyers these days?
Well, I made a big speech for the Puerto Rican National Lawyers Guild Convention, about that lawyers better get back to the old style of lawyering, that being that, you know, when you go into that courtroom, you are the only person that your client has, and you have got to be the champion, just like the guys who rode out on the steeds with the lances back in the Middle Ages. You know, you have got to fight for your client. And I cited some examples from the career of Bill Kunstler, who really enjoyed taking on the government and fighting the government. And also, you know, for myself, you have to say to yourself, we are the one that stands between our clients and absolute despotism. And if you think that that has anything to do with, you know, being friends with the judge or sitting at the table with the prosecuting attorney, let me tell you, it doesn't. I think the most shocking thing in my prison, wake-up calls were the shocking lack of lawyering that these women got in their cases. And, you know, obviously part of the problem is being women and being poor. The lawyers thought, well, we don't really have to do anything for folks. People, lawyers have to understand you have got to look at folks just like they are the most important, as if you're the last person you're going to talk to before they lock your office door. And you've got to be aware that the fight for the least among us is really the fight for the most. And that's what we do. I am not happy with lawyering, and that is like a subtext of what I want to do. I, too, want to talk. I received the Arthur Kanoy Award from my old law school, Rutgers. And one of the things I said, I want to be like Arthur. I want to inspire young lawyers. I want them to say, and I have had a lot of wonderful, wonderful mail saying, I want to be a lawyer like you. So now I have to get out there and say, to be a lawyer like me, you do this, you do that, you do the other thing. And because I do feel that the lawyering is pretty much going by the board these days.
At Black Agenda Report, we say that you were incarcerated for the offense of zealously defending your client. Is that accurate?
Well, my clients, many times after I was indicted, said, Ms. Stewart, you know, they say you're indicted because you helped that old Muslim minister do his thing. They say, but we know you're here because you fought for guys in Bed-Stuy and the South Bronx and all the clients that needed a good defense. We all knew where to go and who would fight and who wouldn't give up on us. And, you know, to some degree, yes, this was the one that they could jump on and make the excuse for prosecuting me. But I think my career and some of the cases I handled, particularly cases like Larry Davis, you know, a young black man in the South Bronx who stood his ground, dare I say that, against 32 policemen and was acquitted by a jury by reasons of self-defense. I mean, those were the cases that also fed into this. It was not just one case. It was that my career stood for this belief that people who stood in their own self-defense, people who were fighting a righteous battle, should get the very, very best. And that's what I always tried to be.
That was People's Lawyer Lynn Stewart speaking from New York.
The leader of the U.S. Empire and the leaders of the former French and British and Spanish empires all claim to be staunch advocates of human rights. All are part of NATO, the military alliance that claims the right to bomb and invade other countries in pursuit of human rights. Ajamu Baraka says imperialism is giving human rights a bad name. Baraka is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington and a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network. He advocates a people-centered approach to human rights.
Well, people-centered human rights is a subversive, if you will, movement that's been developing here in the U.S. For the last couple of decades. And it was developed in opposition to the limitations of the human rights ideal that has been the dominant approach to human rights struggle since the end of the Second World War. It was developed in opposition to the fact that the potential of the human rights ideal has been hijacked by Western powers who have reduced the notion of human rights to an instrument that justifies their continued hegemony. And even though the ideal has great moral significance and resonates with people around the world, we have witnessed, especially in the last decade, a diminution of its moral power because of its open manipulation by these Western countries and the collaboration of Western human rights organizations in subverting the notion of human rights and reducing it to an instrument for Western imperialism.
And the most perverse expression of that Western human rights frame of mind is military humanitarian intervention, as it's called.
And the responsibility to protect, which is no more than a 21st century rearticulation of the white man's burden. At the center of this notion of humanitarian intervention and the responsibility to protect is something that the human rights advocates don't talk about. And that is that at the center of this ideal is the notion, the unacknowledged ideal, that at the apex of human civilization are the nations of the West, the nations that have been driving the so-called modernization process, this project of modernization in which their societies and the liberal state represents the ultimate expression of humanity. And therefore, they have a right, being the members of those societies, to be able to impose on the rest of us their idea of what should be the ideal society and what should be the range of rights that all of us are exposed to. And it's that idea that provides the glue, if you will, the ideological glue between white workers and their white bourgeoisie and the white Western human rights organizations. This notion that they have a right and the responsibility to pull up humanity, if you will, to their level is a backward idea, but something that many of them embrace unconsciously.
Here we have a Europe and its satellites who for 500 years have enslaved virtually the entirety of the rest of the world, setting themselves up as arbiters of what civilization is and what human rights is.
Exactly. And with the advance, this is notion of human rights universality. And it's a very attractive sort of notion that we all have fundamental human rights. But what they don't talk about is who defines the range of those human rights? What is the civilizational imagination in terms of what we should have as fundamental rights? When you begin to unpackage what all that means, you come back to the conclusion that what they see as the range of human rights neatly conforms with the range of rights and the worldview of classical liberalism. With its individualism, its commitment to private property, and market fundamentalism. So it becomes a shell. This notion of universality, it becomes an ideological shell for advancing Western classical liberalism and its ideological weapon of the Western bourgeoisie.
And the framework of apology for capitalism and neoliberalism and white supremacy and colonialism and imperialism.
And that's what the people-centered human rights approach does, that we don't pretend that the human rights ideal is some neutral apolitical concept. We understand that the fight for human rights is a political process. It is a fight for power. At the base of the people-centered human rights approach is the notion that if we are going to be able to realize the full range of our human rights, and at the center of the human rights ideal is the notion of human dignity, if we're going to be able to realize the full range of our human rights, if we see that societies are organized in such a way to prevent that realization, if they are organized to perpetuate oppressive relationships, then the responsibility of a human rights activist is to fight for fundamental social change. It is a call for revolutionary transformation, because if the structures are such that they deny us our fundamental human rights, then it becomes clear what the historical task must be. It must be to change those structures. So we don't pretend that this is not a political project. It is. Just like on the other side, their project is fundamentally political.
So essentially what you're saying is that the world doesn't need what the liberals and neoliberals would call a human rights revolution, but the world needs a revolution in order to achieve human rights.
Exactly. The two are fundamentally interconnected. But we say that the people-centered human rights ideal is part of that counter-narrative to the limitations of Western human rights, and we say that it is a re-articulation of what human rights should be from the point of view of the people who have been marginalized and oppressed. And so the potential of a human rights ideal is liberated when we decolonize human rights from our needs and our perspectives.
And from this neoliberal human rights perspective, we see a billionaire incarcerated for 10 years, but a billionaire and still very rich man, Khodorkovsky of Russia, lionized as a kind of a symbol of human rights in the world.
Well, and we see that example. We see other examples. We see how the way they lionized the constructed ideal of Nelson Mandela and the whole process of truth and reconciliation, that the ANC embarked on once they assumed so-called power. We see that neoliberalism, this economic project, does not in any way talk about any fundamental human rights for working people and poor people. But yet, you know, people who champion neoliberalism, like Brother Mandela, Barack Obama, are the ones who also are able to project themselves as defenders of human rights. So these are some of the ideological limitations, the distorted worldviews that are projected and used by many advocates of so-called human rights that the people-centered human rights approach is attempting to try to move away from.
So a people-centered human rights must embody values that are, in fact, antithetical to capitalism and capitalist social relationships.
Exactly. As opposed to the values of classical liberalism grounded in individualism, property rights, market fundamentalism, inequality, its natural expressions. People-centered human rights, the ethical foundation, says that at the center of our approach are the notions of solidarity, community solidarity, human solidarity, a commitment to equality, egalitarian societies, collectivism. Our values, our approach, our commitment to anti-oppressive relationships are fundamentally opposed to the philosophical foundation of classical Western liberalism, which is the foundation for the human rights framework emanating from the West.
In a practical sense, how would the values of people-centered human rights affect the way folks organize in U.S. society, for example?
On two levels. That basically, the people-centered human rights approach is part of the counter-narrative that we have to develop in order to develop the kind of radical, critical consciousness in order for people to then engage in action. So it becomes an important part of the ideological struggle that we are involved in. Secondly, you connect that to the framework that we can use from the perspective that we have fundamental human rights, that there is a framework of human rights that has certain kinds of norms, even though those norms are still limited, that say things like, for example, that social and economic and political policy on the local level should be guided by these human rights principles. We can use that approach as a framework for assessing social policy, for advocating and pushing for progressive social policy that sharpens the contradictions between ourselves and the 1% that is attempting to try to maintain things as they are. So it becomes another instrument in assessing social policy, a political policy, sharpening the contradictions, and raising the consciousness that allows us to have a clearer sense of the strategic objectives we need to be involved in as we struggle for fundamental social transformation.
So, for example, no politician who advocated increased military budgets or austerity in terms of people programs would be allowed to wrap him or herself in the flag of human rights.
Exactly. Austerity is fundamentally opposed to any notion of human rights. Militarism is an organized expression of the violation of human rights. So the human rights framework, the people-centered human rights framework, becomes a framework that we use to assess policies, to assess people's positions, and to suggest the kind of alternatives we have to pursue in order to address all of the ills that we are facing in this society and globally. So it removes a veneer of respectability for these politicians so that Susan Rice can't talk about, can't go to China and castigate the Chinese for the human rights policies in China and their imprisonment of political prisoners. Biden can't raise questions with the Chinese or anybody else when we can point to the kind of systematic violations here in this country with the political prisoners, with the National Defense Authorization Act, with the FBI raids, with fiscal policy that continues to move wealth from the working class and poor to the 1%, with them turning their backs on the pensioners, the largely black pensioners in Detroit, who are having their pensions raided by the looting of Detroit by the corporate bankers. So we are able to remove the veneer of respectability from these individuals who are pretending to be defenders of this very limited ideal, their ideal of what human rights are really all about.
Ajamu Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
Washington, D.C. City Council is soon expected to pass a bill decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. Currently, Washington arrests more black people for marijuana possession than any other major U.S. population center, a distinction detailed in a report by the nation's capital chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Seema Sadanandan is program director for the local ACLU and helped put together the report on selective drug law enforcement in Washington.
It wasn't just that black people were getting arrested for marijuana more so than any other community, particularly white people, but it's that, you know, the district is now about 50% black and 50% white with regards to the adult populations. And we know that the behavior of consuming marijuana, possessing marijuana, is approximately equal amongst black and white communities. So where you see racial disparity of this kind, it does tend to indicate that it's something to do with the policing behavior. And so after launching, you know, a series of community forums and in which we brought out the chief of police and the council members and engaging, you know, the entire district in a discussion over the past 6 months, we have seen this decriminalization bill gain attention, not just here in the district, but nationally. It's one of the most progressive decriminalization bills in the country for several reasons. One, because it decriminalizes an ounce of weed or less so that it is no longer a crime to possess that amount of weed or marijuana. It's now a civil citation. It's also the lowest civil citation amount for decriminalized marijuana possession in the country, which is $25, as opposed to the hundred and hundreds of dollars civil citations in other areas where marijuana has been decriminalized. But probably most importantly, with regards to, you know, the issue of mass incarceration, what makes this bill so powerful is the language on pretextual stops. And we know, based on anecdotal evidence, that marijuana has long been used in the district as a pretext to stop, search, and harass African-American people and people of color here in the district. And the language of this bill is a powerful collection of some of the best language in the country on how marijuana cannot be used. The odor of marijuana can no longer be used as a pretext to stop and search someone. Possession of marijuana cannot be used as a pretext to initiate a search of a person's possession. And so what we're hoping is that as much as we care about marijuana decriminalization and we see it as, you know, a part of what's driving mass incarceration, that is the criminalization of drugs, we're also hoping that this becomes sort of a stepping stone to initiate a series of criminal justice reforms that target racial profiling, whether it be community-based racial profiling or racial profiling of individuals.
To address just how much disparity there is in D.C. in terms of race and marijuana, in Washington, D.C., the arrest level for blacks is more than twice as much as the national arrest level for blacks on marijuana charges, even though the national level of black arrests on marijuana charges are wildly disparate when compared to whites.
Right, that's exactly right. So when you look at the overall arrest rate nationally, the arrest rate per 100,000 people is somewhere approximately around 240, 250 per 100,000 people. So that's like sort of your baseline. When you look at the arrest rate in the District of Columbia, and it's 840. I think it's about 840, 845 per 100,000 people. Now, if you were to break that down in arrest rates for white people versus arrest rates for black people, arrest rates for white people in the District of Columbia is about 100, 150 or so per 100,000. Arrest rates for black people in the District of Columbia is something closer to 1,400 per 100,000 people. And in certain neighborhoods, the arrest rates for black people is 3,000 per 100,000 people. So what does this mean? This means that there is police contact, which is producing the displaying of that one possesses marijuana. Now, the police would like to argue that that's because African American, black people tend to consume marijuana publicly. And even if in some cases and in some particular communities, marijuana is consumed publicly, it is in a way it can account for the level of disparity that we're seeing across the district.
In fact, it does appear that police in D.C. are so busy busting extraordinary numbers of black people for marijuana that it's led to the arrest rate for marijuana for whites in D.C. being lower than it is for whites nationally.
Yeah, and that's an incredible statistic given the fact that in the area west of 16th Street in Washington, D.C., an area where there were virtually no arrests for marijuana possession, that is one of the highest marijuana consumption, self-reported marijuana consumption areas in the country outside of one place in rural Alaska. So we're talking about not just disparity on the basis of race, but disparity even in the face of evidence that marijuana is being consumed in extraordinarily high amounts in this one particular part of the city. And so what we're saying is not that, you know, we should arrest more white people. What we're saying is that the collateral consequences of these drug arrests, you know, function to create second-class citizenship, and that marijuana long since has been disproven to be a gateway drug, but we know now that marijuana arrests are a gateway into the criminal justice system. And so even if, you know, you're given some type of diversion program or you are after being arrested, you have a year where you're under supervision or whatever it may be, the collateral consequences of having a drug arrest on your record can prevent you from employment in the future, financial aid, can impact child custody decisions, and furthermore, being under the supervision of the state has a profound impact on people and their possibility of being pulled into that prison pipeline. We know that the majority of people who are getting arrested are not teenagers standing on the corner. You know, a lot of times when you hear about this conversation about drugs, and particularly marijuana, there are these characterizations of young black men standing on the corners. But when we broke down the arrests by race, we found that they really weren't young men. In fact, less than 4% of the total population of arrests were of juveniles. The majority of them were men between the ages of 18 and 40. So these are grown-ups, adults, who are being stopped, and not just in their so-called neighborhoods, but anywhere they went. So it didn't matter what the population of black people in a particular area were. It seemed that no matter where black people went, that's where they were being stopped. And so what we learned from New York is that in order for police to capture this much contraband, particularly marijuana, they must be, you know, more than likely this reflects, you know, a drop in the bucket of, you know, hundreds and thousands of stops that are occurring here in the district that, unlike New York, are largely undocumented.
So it seems in Washington, D.C., this new bill will simply expand the area in which marijuana is decriminalized. Since you have long had a de facto decriminalized marijuana bust-free zone in the white northwest of Washington.
Right. That's exactly right. And so the marijuana decriminalization is an important piece, but more than anything, it's a symbolic piece. Just before many people went on vacation, we had another hearing which will seal, essentially the D.C. version of expunging the records of those with prior marijuana convictions. This is incredibly important. This is not about forgiveness. And traditionally, where you see expungement here in the country, it's been about forgiveness, and the expungement process reflects that idea. Okay, you paid your debt to society, and then we don't want to continue to punish you, and we will forgive you if you can prove that you've done X, Y, Z. But this bill was really interesting. It was a conversation within the council about how we can restore people and communities. And so, you know, when we think of the impact of returning citizens here in the district, mass incarceration, 3 out of every 4 black men in the District of Columbia will spend time in jail or prison. That's what the statistics say. And this is the heartbeat of mass incarceration here in the district. And so when you think of, you know, where this could potentially lead, if we can establish expungement procedures which reflect restorative justice rather than simply these other models, then that can be, you know, a step in the right direction as we think about decriminalizing other types of offenses. you know, one of the things that Councilmember Wells, who is the chair of the Committee on Public Safety, the Judiciary Committee, the committee that oversees the police, one of the things that he's announced at the last community forum we held to talk about racial disparities in arrest is that there will be a police conduct hearing in February, in which many of the issues that have been raised at these forums will be raised again. And so what we hope to see in that context is to look at the jump out cars, which are the unmarked police cars that roam Black communities here in the district and initiate incredibly violent, aggressive encounters. You know, it's a pervasive experience, almost a coming of age experience for Black men here in the district to have jump out cars, police officers literally jump out at them. You could be thrown against the pavement, pulled out of your car, and searched for drugs or weapons without real articulable suspicion. And we hope that that's something. And even more interestingly, we hope that the council will take the opportunity to look at the metrics of public safety. And one of the most devastating impacts of policing in the era of the war on drugs has been this wide-scale adoption of metrics of public safety, which create perverse incentives that drive racial disparity. So where you're measuring public safety on the number of arrests you're making, then yes, that is going to tend to encourage police departments as a whole to capture the low-hanging fruit. And so it's much easier to make large numbers of arrests if you just drive through the neighborhood and find people and arrest them for very minor offenses versus if you go after the homicide and you do actual police investigation, for example. And so that's one thing that if we're able to put attention to in the district, it'll be revolutionary in a sense. If we start to look at not just the laws, but simultaneously look at the internal policing structures, the internal incentives that exist within police departments, and how are police officers evaluated? How do we measure public safety? How do they receive their overtime, their pensions? What do their performance evaluations look like? And that speaks to the sort of larger values in our society about what keeps us safe.
That was Seema Sada Nandan in Washington. It's been 20 years since President Bill Clinton pushed through Congress his North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Public Citizens Global Trade Watch has released a report on the economic devastation wrought by NAFTA and the other trade treaties that have followed. The report is called NAFTA at 20. We spoke with Global Trade Watch Field Director Alisa Simmons.
We know after 20 years, and to be honest, we've known for a while now that NAFTA has completely devastated the United States manufacturing, period. We know that 5 million jobs have been lost since NAFTA. We know that tens of thousands of manufacturing plants have been closed down, and workers are really hurting. We only have to look to Detroit and what's happened, you know, there in terms of, you know, the bankruptcy and all of the jobs lost as a clear example that trade agreements are designed to serve corporations and not the people, not hardworking Americans, totally devastate our communities.
We were told by President Clinton, who was joined in supporting NAFTA by majorities of Republicans, and as I remember, a minority of Democrats, we were told that reciprocal trade between Canada and the United States and the United States and Mexico would increase. But that trade has been quite unequal in the last 20 years, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I will say first that we at Public Citizen, we just released a report that's NAFTA on 20. So for a lot of the details and the ins and outs for trade wonks and for people who just want to look deeper into the information, I urge you to check that out at www.tradewatch.org. But in terms of exports and NAFTA, this is kind of the junk that we're always sold when presidents want to shove these free trade agreements down our throats. They promise that if they lower tariffs, that U.S. exports will increase, and the exact opposite has happened. What we've seen is that imports, cheap imports into the United States as a result of NAFTA and the WTO, which is another case, but those two are linked, is that we have a flood of cheap, not high-quality imports, and exports and jobs have been lost.
And this seems to be by design, the uniformity of it and the satisfaction that the corporate world gets from the results of NAFTA and NAFTAs 2 and 3 and 4.
Absolutely. One of the things that's really dangerous about these trade agreements is something that's called investor-state dispute resolution. And what it does is it really, this is something that started in NAFTA and has and was included in other trade agreements. We haven't had anything as huge as NAFTA approved, and hopefully we can stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which a lot of people are calling NAFTA on steroids. But investor-state dispute resolution started with NAFTA, and what that does is elevate corporations to the level of nation states. Right? First, corporations wanted to be people. Now they want to be nations. And in that very dangerous elevation, corporations are able to sue countries if for some reason those countries' laws prohibit or somehow impede on that corporation's expected future profits. What that means is that corporations can not only sue countries, but there's this kind of global race to the bottom in terms of standards, in terms of workers' rights, environmental protections. And we've seen as a result of this regime, this investor state dispute resolution regime of NAFTA, is that the environment and workers' rights across the world are being diminished. Again, go to tradewatch.org. There are a lot of cases, the example of Chevron suing the people of Ecuador and winning, you know, a judgment to be paid $18 billion for devastation that Chevron caused. And so we're seeing all of these cases pop up. But when I say that, you know, corporations sue governments, I'm talking about our tax dollars. So these corporations get to come in, sue us for all the things that we fight for, good public health policy, good environmental policy, all the things that the labor movement has done over decades and decades of fighting. Corporations just can come in and wipe all of that away out of threat of suing and to get our tax dollars as payment for that. It's completely ridiculous.
So it seems that corporate expectations for ever-increasing profits now become a demand that is enshrined in a kind of corporate international law that says that corporations that are somehow prohibited from reaching the kind of profitability and ever-increasing profitability they wish now have a tort, a suit against whole countries.
That's exactly right. And people hear this sometimes, and we go out and speak to a lot of folks, and they don't believe it. But we've seen the results of it already. This is not make-believe, and this is something that's very real. Not only are we talking about big multinational corporations, some of these trade deals, you know, they have impacts on all aspects of our lives, almost every aspect of our daily lives, right? So we can talk about food safety, we can talk about internet freedom, we can talk about access to affordable medicines. I already mentioned workers' rights. But one of the things that's also, in terms of thinking about the United States economy and how slow it's been for us to get out of this recession, is the fact that these trade agreements even deal with regulations on banks, in favor of banks. So all of the regulations that we fought for, you know, can be deregulated behind closed doors in these corporate trade deals.
So when we talk about progressive legislative initiatives, even if they were to pass the legislatures of states and the federal government, they could be struck down by corporations on the high seas of trade treaties.
Exactly. These global free trade deals, you know, and I'm free trade in quotes, because what we're finding out is that these are no longer about trade. You know, when I think about trade, I think about kind of the mundane stuff, exports, imports, tariffs, you know, that. If you look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, which is, you were talking about all of the spawns of NAFTA, and this is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, is something that's possibly going to be approved in the first half of this year. But it's NAFTA on steroids, and the, you know, thing is that the TPP is being negotiated in secret, so I can't tell you exactly what's in it, what we know is from leaks. But of the 29 chapters of this trade agreement, only 5 deal with traditional non-trade matters. So the things that corporations can't get past in the light of day, right? The things that they have not been able to push through Congress, like the Stop Online Piracy Act. You remember when, you know, a lot of the public got together, rose up, and fought back against that? we're seeing what we're calling the son of SOPA, the son of the Stop Online Piracy Act. A lot of the same regulations that they wanted to pursue through Congress that got defeated, they're not slipping through the back door in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Right? So if they can't win on equal terms, if they can't win when people rise up, they're saying, okay, you know what, we're not going to give up and try to, you know, to negotiate with members of Congress or to put things forth that would be fair. They can't do that. So they're using free trade agreements as a backdoor to get all of those things. And what those things do is increase their profit, and that's their main goal.
Alicia Simmons of Global Trade Watch in Washington.
There were ominous developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo last week. A very popular Congolese army colonel, Mamadou Ndala, was killed in the war-torn eastern part of the country. Ndala was greatly admired by Congolese young people, some of whom suspect his death was an assassination linked to either the central government in Kinshasa or the hated regime in neighboring Rwanda, or both. Colonel Ndala helped defeat the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels, with whom the Congolese government then signed a peace accord. Kambale Musavuli of Friends of Congo says Colonel Ndala is considered a national hero.
He's very popular in the Congo. The reason why he's popular is he's one of the commanders who has, on the battlefield, won many battles against Rwandan-backed rebels. And he's similar to the deaths of other commanders in the Congolese army who have died after winning battles. The story around him, so you put it in the context, is he was a commander who refused to take orders from Kinshasa. This is a well-known secret among the military in the Congo, is that any time Congolese soldiers win a battle, they always get contradictory messages from the headquarters in Kinshasa. So, for example, they'll take over a town and beat the rebel group. Instead of continuing to fight, they'll receive an order from Kinshasa saying, stand down. No, ceasefire. Let's sign peace accord. And in July of last year, he was determined to not follow the orders anymore because of the embarrassing defeat of the Congolese army in 2012 when the M23 took over the city of Goma. And that also occurred around the same situation where they were told to stand down, and then later they found out they were overrun. So the population knew that. This commander knew that within the military command, there were traitors who would give positions. So he would not answer his calls. He would tell the soldiers, don't pick up your phone. I'm the commander in the field. And he would take the soldiers to the battle to win. So while he was defeating the M23 toward the end of 2013, there was a word that came out from the capital city that he was going to be recalled in the capital city. That angered the population in the east. And they went out and they demonstrated. They said he is not going to leave. It was so tense in the east that the Congolese government had to publicly come out and deny that rumor, saying that we never said that we are going to recall him, and we saw the military victory that he has done. So his killing is very suspicious.
And in fact, it is quite common among Congolese to charge that President Kabila is either in cahoots with the Rwandans or even himself a Rwandan, which brings us to the rebellion that erupted in the capital city, Kinshasa, last week among followers of a Reverend Paul Joseph Munkugubila.
Yes, this is also something that does not hit the mainstream waves, that there is an issue of credibility, the legitimacy of the government and the credibility of the current president in the Congo, who has a dubious history, where you don't know where he came from, how he became the commander. We do know that he was a former Rwandan officer trained under the command of the current minister of defense in Rwanda. And the Congolese for quite some time, not just because of his birth situation for him bringing out his birth certificate, but the decision that he has made over the years, even currently, which will make one wonder, what kind of president is this? Have you ever heard of a country that has defeated a rebel group, signing a peace accord with a rebel group? That's literally what Syria has done, and time and time again. So because of that, the Congolese population, they do not see in him a leadership. They do not see him as the president of the Congo. And while in the international community and allies and friends of the Congo around the world to come at the side so that they can have a representative government.
In fact, the supporters of M23 claim that the agreement that is now in effect is the same as the previous agreement, which would allow the Tutsi fighters as an independent force in eastern Congo.
And this is what has angered many other commanders, including the now deceased Colonel Landala, who said that it does not make sense that we continue to integrate former rebels who have committed human rights abuse within the Congolese military and wonder why the military is inefficient. So the Congolese population is clear that anything that's signed by the Congolese president imposed on the people by the international community will not hold until the people can control the country. But self-determination of the people, that's what's going to be decisive in changing the dynamics of what is always imposed on the people.
Now, the followers of this Reverend Mukun Gubila in Kinshasa rose up. We hear that as many as 50 or more of them have been killed in battles with Congolese troops in the capital. What is behind that small rebellion?
We're hearing many scenarios. Pretty much, we had young Congolese who are followers of Mukun Gubila who took over the state TV. And they were able to broadcast a message to the nation that, you know, we are coming to liberate you, that the Rwandan imposter has fled, referring to Joseph Kabila, the current president of the Congo. But that situation needs to be put in the context of why it happened. Because before even that they went out to take over the state TV, their leader was actually being bombed. His house in Katanga was being bombed. So it was out of anger that these supporters went out and took those actions. Probably it may not have been the best way to address their grievances, but it really demonstrated how, one, there is no security within the country, that no young people, not well-armed, could take over state TV. And second, is the response of the Congolese security forces against these youths. When you see that they were not as armed as people may assume, and we're hearing the death to up to 100 now, yet we don't see the same response around the death of Colonel Ndala. You know, he's being killed on the battlefield, but these youth who have actually legitimate grievances are being massacred, and they're calling them terrorists. When you see those two scenarios, one can tell but the Congolese people are caught in a very vicious circle. Now, on one hand, they have a illegitimate government, oppressive, not afraid to use the security forces to oppress the people and unleash disproportionate power against them. And two, you have the neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, who are always assist, are United States allies, who are supporting arming training rebels within the Congo. And beside those two forces, let's not forget the multinationals, who in the mix of this chaos are still benefiting from the conflict, but continue to either illegally pilfering Congo's resources or just taking it and paying it with a penny on the dollar, while Congolese people are still not benefiting from the many blessings that they have in their land.
Kambale Musavuli of Friends of Congo.
Nelson Mandela has joined the ancestors, but his former wife and comrade in struggle, Winnie Mandela, remains an inspiration to millions around the world. Mumia Abu-Jamal, America's best-known political prisoner, composed this commentary for Prison Radio. It's called For the Love of Winnie.
For weeks since the transition of Dr. Nelson R. Mandela, I have wanted to craft some words about Winnie Madikizela Mandela, born Nomzamo Winifred Madikizela, the second wife of Nelson. Although her role has been downplayed in the present corporate press, this is an abuse of history. For were it not for her long and stalwart struggle to keep Nelson's name out there against the vicious repression of the apartheid government, which banned and banished her, we would not know his name, and the anti-apartheid movement would not have grown as it did. A stunning black beauty, a courageous figure of both her husband and the African National Congress, she endured for years, for decades, and fought hardest of all to bring about the freedom of Mandela. I first read her words years ago in her book, Part of My Soul Went With Him, the tale of her imprisonment and bannings when she was sent to live alone in the whitest areas of South Africa by government order, and I wept. Throughout it all,